Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there! Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Kaboom! It is June 8th, 2022, and welcome to a special Big Blend Radio Authors and Writing Success Show with Nancy and Lisa. You know, we're the crazy mother-daughter travel team. We travel full-time across the country documenting parks and public lands for one of our magazines, which is Parks and Travel. You can check that out at nationalparktraveling.com. We also produce a whole bunch of different magazines all under Big Blend Magazine, so check that out at blendradioandtv.com. Today we are airing live from Lubbock, Texas. We kind of just got here, it feels like, and now we're going to leave again.
Crazy.
I know, but it's cool to be here because there's sunshine and flowers and birds, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. We're having a great time in Lubbock and getting a lot of work done, hanging out with some cool cats, literally, and just excited about today's show. We love panels and talking about how did people get to where they are now, where are they going. We want the inside scoop. We want the scandal. And today we're going to be chatting with six authors. We have two panel discussions talking about their careers and how do they get there, ask them some fun questions. We're going to giggle along the way as usual. But I do want to give a big shout out. Today's show, we work with Books Forward. JKS, many of you will know them from that. They've been going for about 20 years, 20 plus years. And we've been working with them pre-radio even. This year, we're celebrating 15 years of Big Blend Radio, 20 years of Big Blend Magazines, back from the print days. So I think Julie Shirky and us, we all connected online. I'm going to think was the beginning of Twitter. I don't know. Like, it was like a while ago. But all I know is we work with them in bringing authors on our shows, and we work with them primarily because they are the best. They have awesome authors. They are easy to work with. They care about what happens in the world. So they really, they just, I don't know, I think when you have a good staff, a good team, and you have, you bring the right people in your sphere, that it just keeps growing well. It's like a good recipe, don't you think, Nancy?
Right. They do a good job.
They're awesome. Around. And they're part of our Love Your Park, so we go around and get literary stories as we travel too. So we've been to Helen Hunt Jackson. You know, we've got to think about her. We've done all kinds of stories on literary women and men around the country. So it's very cool. And right now they're expanding again. Over 20 years, they're hiring their 11th full-time publicist. Her name is Elaine Mandros. She's a former special education teacher, and they say that she is a literary omnivore.
Okay.
I know. And an influential bookstagrammer, and she applies vivid creativity and passion for every Books Forward title by deftly coordinating news coverage and events for authors, writing and editing diverse content for social media, and assisting with Books Forward social media engagement initiatives. So, hello, Lane.
Wow.
Excited. Yeah, so it's really cool. 11 publicists full-time. I mean, think about that. This is, and I know that they work hand-in-hand with their authors, and we're excited. We have six of them on the show today. Everyone, booksforward.com is the website, and we have Glenn Rockowitz joining us. We have Lynn Slaughter, Ilana Rea, Liz Keller Whitehurst, Amy Daughters, and Lori R. Snyder joining us. So are we ready to get started, Nancy? Are you?
Yeah, let's go.
I know you're always ready for anything, right?
I know.
Me too.
Get on.
That's my Fat Cat in Town music. It just feels like that, right? So we got some really cool people. They're not fat cats, but they're cool cats. How about that? We're going to start with Glenn Rockowitz. Glenn is an amazing author who's written two memoirs. His second one is out, called Cotton Teeth. He is award-winning. He is a writer, a filmmaker, and a comedian, and he wrote for SNL way back in the 90s. So I think, that was before we started our magazine, so he knows everything. So welcome, Glenn. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm doing well.
Good.
It's good.
I'm happy to be alive. You know, at this age, you know, for most people, when they hear that I'm 52, it's like, oof, are you going to be okay? You know,
well,
so, yeah, I'm going to survive.
Well, no, this is important. We bring this up because isn't that part of your story, you and your dad, both of you getting cancer? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that. I mean, my joke was just about getting old, but yes, it does.
Dude, things are
apply.
Sagging for me right now. Okay, I'm in my like heading towards the 50s, and all I know, I keep looking at the floor, and I should stop doing that. So I get it.
I think I'm getting shorter too. Yeah. So my story was when I was 28 years old, I was diagnosed with stage 4. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and my doctor was giving me 3 months, and it was my wife was 8.5 months pregnant at the time, and I made the decision to not tell her because she had lost her mother. Her mother had been diagnosed and given 3 months, and then 3 months later she died, and so I didn't want to freak her out in the last 2 weeks of her pregnancy, and so I told my dad, and my dad, who was an atheist, prayed and asked God to give him cancer so that I would be okay. And then 7 days later, which is just purely coincidence because he had been complaining about stomach pains for a year, but he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and so we were both basically looking at months left to live at the same time. And so I was losing my dad as I was becoming a dad, and so it was pretty crazy.
Damn it. So is this you've got Rodeo and Joliet, and you've got Cotton Teeth.
They both Cotton Teeth is the new one, and they cover more or less the same amount of time, or the same time period, I should say. But what I found with the first memoirs, a lot of people wanted to know more about my relationship with my dad in those final weeks and the kind of the stuff, the philosophical stuff we talked about. So this book, Cotton Teeth, came about as a result of wanting to kind of zoom in on those final weeks of, you know, the two of us had together, because I think he had a lot of important things to impart that have served me well throughout my life since.
And listen, we're glad you're here, you know.
Thank you.
Seriously, and I'm sure your wife and child and your dad, I mean, Cotton Teeth, that's a hell of a title too.
Yeah. It comes from a Tom Robbins quote where he says, "May the jaws of death have cotton teeth."
Oh, that's cool.
I like that. I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that. Well, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I know we're going to have some fun, and, you know, life is precious, right? So we've got to make every ounce count, and that's what we're going to do today on the show. We've got Lynn Slaughter joining us. See, we're talking about death, and now we're saying Lynn Slaughter. That's just, you know, and she writes mystery novels. I'm sorry. I just had to go there.
So funny.
So you can go to her website, lynnslaughter.com. That's L-Y-N-N, because there's different ways to spell Lynn. And she's an award-winning young adult novelist and mystery writer. And she is a former professional modern dancer and a dance educator. So she can teach us how to swing and move our hips and do all kinds of pivots and twirl our feet and do all that good stuff and maybe not look like an elephant in the room. So welcome, Lynn. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's lovely to be here with you.
It's great to have you here. And you've got to be excited. You've been winning awards on your books, and you've got Deadly Setup coming out July 5th, right? So
yes.
4th of July weekend, you've got to get ready for a mystery to happen right after
That's
that
right.
4th of July. Yeah.
Ooh.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about Deadly Setup.
It's about a young woman who ends up going on trial for the murder of her mother's fiancé. And she has to work to prove her innocence with the help of her boyfriend's father, who happens to be an ex-homicide cop. Very convenient to have a boyfriend with a dad like that. But that's basically the premise of the book.
So you're in Louisville, Kentucky, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Ooh, we love your area. We love Kentucky.
Yeah.
you got good bourbon out there and good horses. And, you know, I'm just saying.
We do.
I just kind of feel like murder in, like, you know, the bourbon manufacturing place, the bourbon distillery places could happen. Like, someone could get in a, I don't know. There's just, it, you know, there's something about the South and mysteries, and there's just something mysterious. And you've got a lot of good water with good limestone that makes good bourbon. I'm just saying that I think you could set up a lot of mysteries out in the bourbon country.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Actually, our Sisters in Crime group here has an anthology called Mystery with a Splash of Bourbon, which is all about mystery stories that are connected to bourbon, which is very big in our state. So there's a lots and lots of material here.
It's very big in our life.
See, people talk when they drink bourbon.
Yes.
They talk, you know, when normally they wouldn't, and they give them some bourbon, and then blah, 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 blah.
No. But actually, no, the history of bourbon in Kentucky, we just interviewed Carl Reitz. He's a professor from Kentucky State, and he's written all these books on the history of bourbon, and it's really fascinating. And it gets into, all the way to how pigs, Kentucky, because of how they had to feed the spent grain to the pigs. And then how the, it's a whole thing. But all I'm saying is, if you're going to talk about bourbon in Kentucky and murder mysteries and things like that, then you've got to involve a pig. But but it's cool. You talk about the Sisters in Crime. We were saying before we went on air that we did a show, a monthly show last year with the Tucson Sisters in Crime. And I had no idea how women really just plot murder. Like, I knew Nancy and I could get a little sadistic, but holy cow, man, these women were giving people anthrax. They were, we brought the last show, we said, okay, everybody, what's your weapon of choice? And one woman brought out a gun, like, on the show. I'm like, holy cow, I'm glad you're in Tucson and we're wherever we were, you know.
Right.
Yeah, don't mess with the sisters.
Well, I'm president of our local chapter of Sisters in Crime, and I have to tell you that, yes, there's lots of discussion of various ways of killing people.
This is very nice. So I don't know if our next guest here, Ilana Rea, who was on our show a few months ago with her book, The Epic Mentor's Guide, and she is awesome. She does a lot for young girls connecting with mentors so they can move forward in their career. She's written two books. And welcome back, Ilana. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm great.
Hey,
cool.
It is good to have you back. And I want to say, like, would you go to a Sisters in Crime? Like, would you go to Lynn and say, hey, we've got, you know, a girl that wants to commit murder?
I think this is the kind of mentorship that you have to walk really slowly into. You know, this is where you step gingerly. I mean,
yes.
I'm all about role models, but I think here's where we need to redirect that girl.
Okay. But, and listen, you are are you still practicing law, corporate lawyer?
I'm not.
She's like,
I'm
done.
Such a happy, nerdy lawyer for so long. And I did mergers and acquisitions, so, you know, nothing murder-related at all. But no, I'm not practicing anymore.
So in other words, she was not part of the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial, which we still want to make jokes about. You shouldn't make jokes about it, but you have to in some ways. But, I think it's what you're doing for young girls is so important. You've written two books, and I think that is a really cool way for girls to be able to read, ingest, but also take action, because it seems with both your books and what you're doing with, is it etregirls.com? Am I pronouncing this? I always get this messed up. Etregirls.com.
I mean, if we were French, we would say it in a cooler way, but it's Etre, which in French means to be. And so the idea of the company name is helping girls figure out who they want to be.
See, and I even listened to our last interview just to say Etre correctly, and I didn't do it right again.
Perfect.
Yeah, but Etre, etregirls.com is a website, but this is this cool platform that you have for young girls to connect with their mentors, and I think having the book as a tool, like a go-to, both of them are really important for them to connect, but it seems that everything you do is very action-based. It's not just read and hope. It's about get at it.
I think that's true, and I actually love that you said that. You know, my theory has always been since I started this, you know, I had such incredible mentors while I was practicing law, and so many of them were women, and I just kept thinking there's no reason to underestimate that next generation. I don't think you're ever too young to have a mentor or lean into something that you love and then go find an expert who can give you some guidance and act as a springboard. And, you know, it is a more active thing. It's not the same thing as saying I'm finding role models and I'm holding them out and saying, girls, follow these women on social media. The women in the book, the book you're referring to, Epic Mentor Guide, put together a series of questions from girls all over the world about work. You know, how do you get an internship at SpaceX? How do I get my art seen at Pixar? How do you get a sketch on SNL? And then 180 women answered the questions, but they answered them in a really active and impactful way. Every one of the women gave her favorite social media handle so the girls could continue to reach out and DM her and stay involved. And it does, I hope, have an active feel for every reader.
Yeah, and the first book was Etra, Girls, Who Do You Want to Be? So you're already putting him into action mode, like, oh, I'm going to, you know. So it's a really great follow-up. And I love that you brought up SNL because we'll have to talk to Glenn about that. But I do. You were on the Today Show. I was watching that today, and you rocked it totally. And
thank you.
I love that you got all these other women that were part of the book on there. What has the response been since the Today Show? I mean, it's been a few three months since we chatted with you.
March 15th. Yep.
Yeah.
It's been insane. It's been unbelievable, and I'm so just grateful every day. What's been incredible is that women are coming out of the woodwork to say, I'd love to be a mentor. I have wisdom to impart. And the girls, you know, from as early as middle school and all the way up through college are DMing new questions. Hey, if I could ask this soccer player this. Hey, could I ask an astronaut this? And so we're actually just continuing the conversation. We started a newsletter on LinkedIn called the Epic Mentor Newsletter to do exactly this, to keep the questions going and reach out to women on LinkedIn to keep those questions being answered. And the options ahead, I think, are so many to keep these curious questions, finding responses for them.
I'd love that because, yeah, I really hate how society determines, oh, this generation is this, and they give it a name that isn't really positive for the people in that generation. I'm like, what are you doing? You're now like training these people or telling them they're less than good or what you want them to be and giving them a name that they have to contend with. I mean, why do we do that as society? Why not give them a good name? Like the generation thing. Why do we do that? I don't get it.
Well, to be fair, there's no other generation since Generation X has been any good, so it makes sense.
There you go. See, it's true.
My girls are going to prove you wrong.
Hey, listen. You know, but this is the thing. I think this is where books can make change.
Yeah.
And so, Glenn, for you, writing the two memoirs, I mean, writing about cancer and death and those emotions, that is not an easy thing. Or was it an easy thing for you to write? I mean, was it cathartic? Was it therapeutic? What was it like to write both memoirs? Because I think what you've done is really help people to connect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little ironic, too, because I was diagnosed 2 years after I had started an organization in New York that brought live comedy into the homes of people who were homebound AIDS patients and cancer patients. So I wasn't sick. We would go and we recreate a comedy club. We bring in three comedians and an actor playing a waiter and an actor playing a heckler, and we would set up a comedy club and we would do hundreds of shows. And this was before I got sick. I think I inherently had an affinity for the power of humor, of laughter and healing, and you know, and of course it got put to the test many times over since for me. But I'm still doing it today. I still do pro bono clinical advocacy for patients who are young people who are diagnosed, because I was 28 at the time, and I've had three other cancers since. And it's a scary, overwhelming thing, and so I kind of make it. Thankfully, I have a career that allows me to do the work for free, so that they don't have to be alone the way I was. Mm. So,
and writing is therapy. I mean, there is this, you're going rerunning things, and then there's also this creative part of it. So for you, writing a memoir, going from writing skits, right, and from that to, does it hold hands at all? Because I think in whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, unless it's a how-to guide, but even then they need to put some humor in those IKEA things, how to screw this and put this together. If someone said, and at this point you need a margarita, we'd all feel better about it, or a meatball because it's Swiss, But with the memoir, does humor help you to get messages across in a memoir?
I mean, it really does. And I have always sort of gone back to what my grandmother once said to me when she died of colon cancer. But when she was at her sickest, I would go visit her and we would just laugh. And she said to me it was the only kind of time of the day or week where she felt like she was being let out of prison. Like, she said it was such a relief, mm-hmm. And so I think, I don't know where I was going with that. That's the fun side.
The humor.
Fun side effect of chemo. Yeah,
humor just, going into your memoir. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and she said, what she said to me was, just because you add light to a situation doesn't necessarily mean you take a situation lightly. And
right.
That always stuck with me because, I do try to inject humor into everything, and not because I don't take it seriously, but because I feel like we all need it to really deal with a lot of the difficult things that we have to deal with, no matter what it is in life.
I think comedy and music and the written word, but, books are private. When people read a book, it's private. You're on your own. You can discern what you want. You can take what you want, believe what you want, create what you want. It's a co-creative process. And so there's a healing in that, and an escapism and creativity. I think that's such a powerful thing that each of you authors bring to the table, whether it's memoir, fiction, mystery, how-to. You are allowing someone to create that process, And Lynn, I want to go to that with you, is going from dance, because dance is creative. And having to put yourself out there. I mean, it's like, I'm going to do a jump. And I did modern dance at one point in my life. And, you could say, I'm going to jump here. And then all of a sudden, my thigh says, no, you ate Jell-O.
You're not
my Jell-O, and I'm going to show you that. So dance is hardcore. Tell us a little bit about going from dance to writing mystery, because I think there's a little bit of mystery in dance, because you're always – it's the dynamics, right, in dance, like in music, that you're showing the audience, and you don't want to play your card all at the tape. You don't play everything in the beginning of the dance. You have to lead people on. So there's kind of a similarity, isn't there?
I think definitely there is, and I really consider – anything in the performing arts, as well as things like writing, to be risk-taking behavior. You're putting yourself out there. You're making yourself vulnerable. But to pick up on what Glenn said, I think humor is incredibly important and healing. And even in my most serious books that deal with really serious things, they're humor. And that is such an important way that we get through life and make sense of things. So, I definitely think that my career in dance has a lot in common with my career in writing. So,
do you find that when you're writing a mystery that you do need to let your audience breathe?
Breathe.
And that you've got like a scene going on and this is happening, but you have to put that dynamic, like in music and dance, you have to allow the exhale to happen so that they can see the next scene.
Absolutely. Well, I write coming-of-age romantic mysteries, so there's usually quite a few layers of things going on, and it's not always just about, you know, oh, my God, there's a car chase or whatever. Yes, you have to. It's just like dance or music or anything that you have to think about the ebbs and the flows as you're creating.
Mm-hmm. You have to have a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I feel mm-hmm. like when I read books, I identify the rhythm, like it's kind of the flow of the book. There's a rhythm.
Yes.
And then when the rhythm changes, you know, something big happened. Mm. And then it goes back
yes.
to the rhythm.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Right.
It's how
I love that.
That's how life mm-hmm. is. I think mm-hmm. that's exactly it, Ilana. That's why I say about the action. With what you write and do is you're an action rhythm, but then you have a point, you know, it's like, here's a question, here's this, but there's an introspective side of what you're doing too. So it allows the girls that are reading to go, okay, let me think about what I want to do and how I want to use this. And also discover
yeah.
things. There's a discovery there too, because these are girls asking questions about specific careers too, that girls reading this may find a new career out of it, actually. Then they may think they want this and then go, hey, wait a minute, I kind of like that over there, you know?
Exactly. It is all about involving the girls. I mean, I will say, you know, at the outset, I'm the most accidental author that there is. You know, I'm in awe of people who can write, you know, fiction like Lynn or a memoir like Glenn. I mean, it's just not that hasn't been my experience. The first book, in part, was to get the girls in, you know, published. The book had articles that I had written for Huffington Post and Thrive and Ms. Magazine and other places, but layered within that were quotes from 40 women and 50 girls. And they got to see their name. You know, Melissa from Tennessee has this quote or wants to respond, and her quote might be right next to Arianna Huffington's or something like that. And the focus of that book was really to highlight the girls' words and talk about what they wanted to do. This book, the same thing. It's the girls' questions. Hundreds of girls sent questions in, and that's really what I wanted to feature. So I feel like I'm almost not the author as much as I'm sort of the conductor or the arranger or something like that. But I do like if it spurs them to action. And I think particularly, you know, this was a COVID project. Initially, this started because ETRA, we normally take girls into companies to meet female leaders, right? That's really what we do. I take groups of girls into companies that they pick, like Google, like Spotify, like NBC, the Stock Exchange, and they meet female leaders face-to-face, and they meet their mentors, and they ask their questions. COVID hits, and all of a sudden that action that you're talking about is just taken away. We can no longer do that.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we going to still keep this momentum going and keep girls meeting mentors when they need them? We just started DMing people and submitting questions or doing it virtually. You know, five women from Billboard were going to talk to girls. And when we got the answers, that's really how the book came about, was all of a sudden this action that had been stymied by COVID, and how can we bring it back?
Oh. Mm-hmm. See, you are the action girl. That's it. You, no matter what, if that action word is sticking with you, you need to have the badge of action, because, you know, that's the thing. When something doesn't work, and I think all writers go through this, you know, you may have a scene, and you know, we've talked, how many, I can't even count how many authors, musicians, comedians, you know, interviews we've done over the years where it's like suddenly one of the authors, like their character will start talking to them and then their whole book changed. You're like, and I'm going, what, are you psychic? Like, that's kind of weird. But it apparently happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to me, it's like, I'll have a glass of wine and I'll tell you there's 10 people in my head right now. But Ilana, you're actually going out and talking to them and connecting. But for you to be the arranger and put it together, and Nancy, we kind of do that with a magazine too. It's like that.
Mm-hmm.
Put them all together, but
and make it
your
make sense.
Writing, has to be good. So does your background as a lawyer come into being short and sweet and deliver that message, and then let what the message of the mentors and the girls, the mentees, shine? So you have to be able to do that push and be, just get it done. You know what I mean?
It's a great question. It's a great question. I think probably yes. You know, I think I'm a very curious person by nature. And I think that leads you to law. I'm always asking why. Tell me how that mm-hmm. works. Explain that to me. So that curiosity mm-hmm. certainly fueled it. And I also will chase the answer down. You know, if I've gone to someone and said, hey, can you answer this? And she says, oh, I'm not the right person, but this person is, I will follow that just to the end of the line, absolutely, to get the answer. And that, I think, also is from legal research or mm-hmm. That type of thing. So yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. It's a really great question. But, yes, I think it probably does inform what I do now.
And I bring that up because I think there's a lot of people who started writing, maybe as a teen and as a kid or, you know, second career, whatever. And life, you do what you need to do in life, right? And you don't get to that opportunity. And Lynn, maybe you can speak on that too. You always wrote, right, as a kid. And then, you know, life gets in there. But I think all of our experiences in life are going to add to what you write. Glenn, could you speak on that with your life experiences? I mean, in comedy, writing skits, writing jokes, and things that people are going to act out that, you know, maybe you don't act out, but they do, like in SNL. Like, what, I mean, don't you look at day-to-day life of what is going on for you, too?
I mean, I really do. It's, you know, my mother was telling me recently that she said when you were a baby, which was, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, she said you would just sit there and study everything. You were very quiet. You were just like studying everything. And I think comedy really is about studying nuance in behavior and it's pointing out that behavior to people in a way that allows them to laugh about it and you know, or recognize it or identify with it. And I feel like all comedy is sort of fueled by that experience, and it's the collective experience that makes, you know, things successful in comedy. You know, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, Seinfeld's sort of observational humor is so popular, or certainly was so popular, because, you know, he would take something so ordinary, you know, and make you look at it a different way. There was a comedian by the name of Mitch Hedberg who was similar to sort of Stephen Wright, very dry sort of one-liners, but like he would say things like, you know, rice is a great thing if you want to have 1,000 of something. You know, if you, you know, or like, you know, giving someone a flyer is another way
immediately
of
I wanted
saying,
to
here,
choke.
You throw this out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, do you have any tips for writers that want to infuse comedy into their book? Because comedy has got to be the hardest damn thing to write, because you could bomb on a page. You could bomb on shape and be like Norm MacDonald we were talking about earlier, and like before we went on air, like, and he'll just like, he'll say, okay, I'm sailing with the bomb and I'm going down and I'm going to keep going. I don't care. But like other people like, oh, crap, I bombed. I'm going to come back or not, you know. But on paper,
yeah,
that's like you went on paper.
I think you can. I mean, first of all, I've bombed everywhere, in paper, wherever it is, plastic, it doesn't matter. I've bombed everywhere. So that's part of the process. But I really do think that the sort of the trick of infusing humor into writing, you know, right, obviously humor is so subjective, but I think if you come from a place, from a very loving place, and if you come from a place of empathy where you want to provide the reader with a break, like you were saying earlier, like an exhale, you know, just to sort of lift the heaviness of it. I think if you come from that place, it'll always be successful on some level. Like, yeah, I think people will identify with it and enjoy it, even if it's not, you know, roll on the floor laughing. Just the laugh is such a welcome relief, and I think if it comes from a good place like that, it'll land.
It's true, because, I mean, we are herd animals, and people hate that, but we are. We're like cattle. We follow a leader. We all herd together, and then some of us branch off and go, I'm not doing that anymore. And that's a rough road. It's harder than if you just follow. And if you can't turn around and laugh at how we behave and realize, you know, I think we're still trying to, oh, well, I'm so going to get in trouble for this. But We're still trying to break the mold of what a human is. versus the rest of the animals and mammals on Earth. We don't really want to be categorized as a monkeys or
a cow?
Or goats, cows. We don't want to be like we're them. So who are we, you know? And so we're trying to be different, but then we all herd together, but then some of us don't. So we're this big mixed bag. And it's funny.
Hmm.
I mean, it, because otherwise it's really sad.
Human beings are weird. And then we act out and do weird things. And that brings us over to Lynn. Lynn, you're writing mysteries, and so you get to be writing about the weird things about people, because I think there is humor in mystery, because people are doing weird things, man, you know?
Yes, yes, they are. That's true.
So,
I wanted to just pick up, too, on something that Glenn said, which is that he's bombed everywhere. And that is one of the things that I think is so key to being able to do any kind of creative work, is that you have to be willing to fail.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yep.
You know,
yep.
And you have to be willing to take those chances and to take those risks. And that's where some really good stuff comes out. So I just wanted to
compliment
Glenn.
Yeah.
On the point that he was
dance.
Making.
Yeah, you taught dance, too. And, I mean, if you're going to dancers fall down. And I know, like, I've done that. I mean, I've shown my butt to... Listen, I took a surfing class, and my butt went up to the pier. Like, people were looking over the dock, and here's my butt. And I'm like, all hail Lisa's butt.
Oh, Lisa, I've always been proud of you.
No, I know, but anything to do with me going on water, my butt is up in the air, or I'm going in circles.
Yeah, she
that's
has
it.
A flotation device.
I have a, well, that's called my butt. But anyway, so, but it is, you know, and I found that when you do not do well, it is better to do humor. Like, I know my butt will go in the air if I end up trying to surf.
Right.
I know that. I might as well embrace the big floatiness of my butt. If I'm going to go out of water,
like, she could skydive
then
and not need a parachute.
Like, you don't get mad at yourself.
Right.
Be proud that
right.
you even tried and make fun of it. But you're going to learn. You're still going to have to take those lessons and go, and that's your private time. Go, okay, well, maybe you should wear some pants, you know, for that butt. You know, maybe there's compression pants for the butt. I don't know.
Oh,
but I'm just saying. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Ow.
You could fix it. But that's the thing.
How would you walk in compression pants for the
but
butt?
But I'm interested in Lynn being a dance teacher and dancing, and you are putting yourself out there on stage, and then you're teaching people to put themselves out on stage, and you see them shine, you see the bombs, you see all of that, and then you're writing, and here's a mystery, and you know, like, the mystery, you, I mean, we read it. We read mysteries to watch the criminal bomb. Literally, and to try and take him down. So you are the bomber.
Well, you know, there was someone who once said that fiction is the writer's revenge on reality, and that you can have it sort of come out all right, you know, and that with some semblance of hope at the end in your fiction, or you can bring the bad guy to justice or whatever, and that doesn't necessarily happen in real life, so.
Yeah, and we do like the underdog, and we do like the naughty people that we know are dangerous. What is that? We do. We want the villain.
Aspect.
We like the villain. We're attracted to villains.
It's more interesting somehow. Mm. You know, it's like if it's just a little bit of naughty. I'm not saying they have to be a murderer, but have a little spice. That's all.
Yeah. I think it's because we secretly want to do bad things as human beings.
Like,
we want to just do it for a day and see what happened. You know what
of
I mean?
Course.
Not necessarily kill anybody, but we just want to see how could we get away with this. You know,
it's
like
called
takes us back to our childhood.
Jokes.
Yeah, yeah. Ilana, I want to go to you. I mean, so what would you do about a girl bombing with a big butt and floating in the ocean? But seriously, I mean, were any of the topics that you covered in both books about what do you do when you do bomb.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the courage to fail, right? Be brave enough to fail. I think that that's just basic, and it threaded itself through, certainly through so many of the quotes that came in for this book, the idea of resilience, the idea to be brave enough to pivot. And that advice, you know, from so many women, you know, who might have started in one career, Dawn Porter, who started as a lawyer and then went on to make movies with Oprah, a major pivot, and she said she was brave enough to ask, what if? What if I didn't do this thing that I'd been trained to do and thought I was going to set myself on a track and continue to do? You know, one thing that's been interesting is that it's not just necessarily girls who are gaining advice from this, but look how many women coming out of the pandemic now have changed direction, have pivoted, have said, I stepped off of the workforce right now, and now I'm onboarding back in, and I want to do something entirely different. The freedom, the bravery to say, I'm going to try this, and I might be horrendous at it, and I'm going to leave a career where I was perfect, where I had reached that level of expertise, and I'm ready to put it down and try something new. The having the courage to bomb wherever you are is something I don't think you can instill that too early with girls, you know? Reshma Sajani has a fantastic TED Talk where she talks about how we teach girls to be perfect instead of be brave. And I think she's right. I think all of us could use an extra infusion of courage and be willing to bomb.
You can always write a second book or a third book or a fourth or a fifth, right?
What is perfect anyway? That's in the eye of the beholder. So you're never going to be perfect for everybody.
Some of the best books bombed. I mean, look, okay, Gone with the Wind is a no-no book, I suppose. But it's on that list. But some of the biggest authors.
I can't keep up.
I know. But some of the biggest authors got rejected how many times? I mean, rejected. You keep going. And, you know, you could write something that people gave a thumbs up to, and then it bombs. Doesn't that happen in the comedy world?
Yeah, it happens all the time. We see it happening all the time. If you, I mean, especially now with more frequency.
Yeah, and, you know, we do have an age now where we can self-publish, we can work through smaller publishers, we have so many things at our fingertips. Things can just fail, and then you have to look at it and pick yourself up and keep going and learn. Failure leads to success. As an organization, we work with 8 keys of excellence. Second key of excellence is failure leads to success.
Right. If
really
you pick
true.
Yourself up.
Yeah. And of course, the reality in our lives is that we generally have learned so much more from the things that haven't worked out than the things that have.
Exactly.
So,
it's true. At one point, I paint wildlife. I used to, but now I do in magazines. But I painted in public in South Africa. I would paint wildlife pictures, and then
Glenn, this was a fundraiser for the Cancer Association. We were on the road for a year and a half raising funds for the Cancer Association. Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, cool, until I started it, and I didn't realize how outspoken and rude people can be. Like, you would start a painting and somebody would stand behind you with ice cream chrome and let the ice cream drip on your hair say, I don't understand this painting. Explain it. And I'm like, I'm going to hit you. You know, I'm like, well, you just have to be patient. He goes, I don't have to be anything. I'm like, well, you made it. You know, I had to tone my response down. I had to get public worthy, and it was really hard.
I know,
really hard.
We have a really good question to come up on this. I know we had, like, here's our set questions, but and we're doing okay with it, but we never stick to the topic. But you really brought up a good point. Writers are writers. Like, like Nancy and I doing radio shows, like, we really prefer just doing this audio, hide behind the thing. No one can see us. We're radio people. And there's a thing about you're writing, you're in your creative space, and then all of a sudden you have to do things like this. And or do a book signing. And then when you're there, you're like, oh, this is nice. I'm meeting the people that are into what I do. But how hard is it to go from one to the other side? I mean, everyone's a different personality, but to like suddenly, like, I have to get away from my desk. And I mean, you guys are all kind of on the presenter sides too with your careers. So, but Glenn, for you, I mean, to get out there in the public and start, you know, I'm not saying kissing babies. Don't do that right now. and don't be a politician.
Oh, God.
They may not like you anymore. But, no, I'm kidding. But you know, what's it like? Let's talk about that for each of you, and then we've got one final question. But what is that like to balance that, the creative and then the I'm out
in
there
public.
To talk to everybody?
I mean, I think, you know, it's a weird paradox because for me, it's my favorite part of the process,
wow. But
it's also, you know, comedians are by nature very introverted people, and, you know, it's the reason they do what they do. You know, it's not always the case with comedians, but for me, like, I kind of have a love-hate relationship with people. I'm always disappointed in them, but at the same time, like, I feel like a strong desire to connect with people, and that's, you know, that opportunity has been kind of the best part of it for me. So I'd be curious to hear what everyone else has to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's go to you, Lynn. What about for you? Because I know you presented as a dancer, but then you're not like talking to the audience from the stage. You know, I mean, it's
that's
different.
True. Although I've done concerts in which I interspersed, you know, stories from my life with the dances. So yes, I enjoy. I guess I enjoy talking to people. I enjoy people. I think people are just fascinating. Their stories are fascinating. I mean, you know, I'm just like, oh, I want to know more about Glenn. I want to know more about Alana. You know, it's just, and you and your mom. I mean, I really enjoy people. I'm inspired by people. At the same time, I do have.
She's going to murder us all in her book.
Yeah. At the same time, I do have an introverted part of my personality because I like my alone time. I like my time writing, which is kind of a solitary activity. So I don't know. You know, when I used to take those Myers-Briggs things and I discovered that I was evenly divided between introversion and extroversion. So,
well, that's balanced.
Maybe that's why I enjoy both. I don't know.
So, do you ever, like, walk around and you're, like, shopping or something and you look at somebody and go, oh, you look like a good murderer?
In the vegetable aisle.
Yeah, yeah, especially when they're squeezing
holding a zucchini.
Guavas or something.
No, he's got exotic fruits. He's a smuggler. Emphatically, it's male. Look at that. It could be a woman.
She's holding.
I don't know if I do that, but I do have to say that, you know, when you do after a while tend to think of just everything that happens to you or you observe in the world around you, people's stories, you think that's material. And you know, it's kind of true. I mean,
I knew it.
This is awesome. So Alana, I want to go to you, you know. I watched you on the Today Show, man. She's just like, come on, bring it. Let's go, girl. Let's do it. So, and you're a lawyer. And then you're connecting with all these leaders in all these, you know, high-end companies. So, I mean, is the presenting part, like, the easy, or do you just, like, I'm going to just let me be to get this task together for the book, for the girls, like, what is that like?
Well, I love it. I have to say I'm embarrassed by how much I love the sort of being out, meeting people. And I was really craving it with this book because I was so worried everything was going to be virtual. So the book came out in March, and I just was so nervous that everything was going to be virtual. And when the events were live, it just felt great. I mean, and everyone was careful and respectful, but it felt fantastic to be in a group and have the questions be live and involve the girls. And I think I had been craving it. I love it. I don't worry about being out there. There are people who are so much better at it than I am, but I really do enjoy doing it. And at the end of the day, you just want to make the girls proud that you've done their project justice by, you know,
cool.
by getting out there and spreading the word.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. I like that. So we're getting to our final part here, and then we play music and bring our next panel on. But we talk about this dinner party always. We want to know who you want to invite to a dinner party.
This.
So this, I'm changing it up from what you guys got emails, because that's how we do things. So we're going to have one big party, right? So it's going to be one big table. You're going to bring people in. So it's going to be interesting. You guys are all going to be there, okay? And Nancy and I will be there. We'll be your wait staff. You know, we'll pour the wine and serve the food.
This is commonly known as the Last Supper.
Yes, yes. But don't ask us to cook it. Don't. That's
right.
Not a good thing, because that will be the Last Supper. but let's see. I like each of you, one person you want to bring to that dinner table, that you want to bring to the table so that you can learn from them, be inspired by them, or laugh, or just you want them there just for something to move on with, that you can garner some information, just inspiration, whatever it is, it's going to do something positive for you. And the person could be alive or passed on. So let's start with you, Ilana. Who do you want to bring to the table? It kind of goes with your mentor book, right?
It does, kind of. I like this. All right, so I'm picking one person.
For now, yeah.
I'm picking Amelia Earhart.
Ooh,
I think,
nice.
Yeah, I think that she would be fascinating,
cool.
as she was a first in so many ways, also a
yeah.
writer, which, you know, I'm picking Amelia.
Ooh,
awesome.
Yeah, we like that. We like
yeah.
that. Ooh. Yes, mm-hmm. And she proved that you could have, excuse me, balls and beauty at the same time. Sorry. True, right? She did. She
yeah.
was like, hey, I could do what the men do and be beautiful. And she represented cosmetic companies and stuff, like, seriously.
She wrote
yeah,
like, for Cosmo. She wrote for Cosmo. She represented brands. She inspired, you know, how many women to take up flight. And, I'm taking Amelia.
She's awesome.
And by the way, I should have said Cajones. We're in Lubbock, Texas right now.
So we could say Cajones
more
now.
More appropriate way to say it. Okay, so Lynn, let's go to you. Who are you bringing to the table?
Well, I probably would like to bring Chris Crutcher, who is one of the gods of young adult literature, and he is also a therapist. A lot of my books have to do with family issues and dynamics, troubled dynamics and dysfunction and all this kind of stuff. He's just a wonderful writer and a terrific person as far as working with teenagers, and that's always been my favorite age group to work with and counsel. So I'd probably pick him.
I like
awesome.
That. I think also, you know, going back to the dance, like how many kids went to dance as an outlet to get over whatever they were going through?
You know,
just even being a teenager, you need an outlet, you know?
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where they're
That's
not
true.
On their phone, they're not dealing with, you know, because I look at what teenagers are going through right now, I swear to God, like, you know, what we had in school, when I was in school, we used to walk around, this was in South Africa, we say, you know, it's not that bad for us because we could be in a concentration camp in Kuwait with no money for cigarettes. Like, that was our thing, you know. But listen, I grew up in Africa, so it was a little different, but,
it's
you
different.
Know, and, you know, it wasn't that easy for girls either.
No.
On the African continent. And there was a lot of crud going on in Africa at that point, as the entire continent, you know, not just South Africa.
Well, it was
very
male-dominated.
Very different. And, you know, but I think about kids now looking at all the changes, all the political strife, looking at, you know, safety, security, looking at climate change, it's got to feel like, I want to do this and this. And I wonder, I just want to quickly go back to you, Ilana. Are you seeing any of those kind of questions coming in of girls feeling you know, they want to go for it, but feeling any kind, or are they just like, I'm just going for it and not looking at these issues? Like, what are you seeing on that front? Because there's a lot of things kind of, you know, that are harder for kids right now that
There definitely are. I mean, I think, in you know, just quickly in general, girls' confidence can drop a considerable amount by age 14. Mm-hmm. You know, 30% is that number we keep seeing. COVID didn't do anybody any favors in terms of feeling isolated and not having their normal outlets, their team sports, those things that bring you into social groups. What I'm seeing, though, with the girls who have been drawn to ETRA is that they have some other passion or interest. And if we can just feed it, if we can just say lean into it, you know, what, are you loving chess? Are you loving sketch comedy writing? Are you loving art? Are you loving dance? Let me put exactly the right role model in front of you right now at this vulnerable, difficult, crucial time. Maybe her confidence doesn't falter. Maybe that girl, you know, is a little bit bolstered and a little protected. And I do think that people have gone out of their way during this time to be inspiring and to be hopeful and to give, to extend the resources whenever they can. I've been really encouraged by how much people are looking out for the next generation right now and making sure that everyone's okay, given this very weird time that they've just been through.
I love it. And do you think that writers getting started, no matter what age, should get a mentor?
Yeah. I mean, I mean, I'd love one. I think there's no right way to be a writer. And so any mentor that can help you tell your story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or memoir or whatever it is, a mentor who can teach someone how to tell their story and raise their voice and be heard, that's worth everything.
And so that goes to your answer for your dinner table question, Lynn, too. So that would be a mentor for you.
Yes, absolutely.
That's awesome.
That's cool.
So, Glenn, going back to you, who's coming to the dinner table?
Well, I was going to say Amelia Earhart, but now
she'll sit between us.
She'll sit between us, yeah. If I had to pick one, it would be Andy Kaufman, just because I think
he...
Oh, I
want to go to that dinner.
I want you all, everybody's at this dinner. We're all there.
Love
Andy
it.
Kaufman, heck yeah. Just come to my
way. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah. Why Andy? He's kind of crazy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, well, that was the thing is I don't think he was as crazy as people thought he was. I think he was really fascinated, you know, sort of what Lynn was saying with the sociological part of, like, what makes people react, what makes people tick. I mean, he pushed it pretty far. But I always have respect for that because it takes a tremendous amount of courage to go out on a limb like that, you know, to get people to think about things in a different way, because I really think ultimately that's what comedy's most important job is to look at things in a way you're not used to looking at them. And I think he did a really good job with that.
No, I just see him as like in Taxi. I see the Taxi thing now.
Yeah.
I'm stuck on Taxi now.
But it's so true because comedy brings the barriers down long enough for you to look at yourself and to maybe shift your viewpoints sometimes.
Comedy is a gear changer.
Yeah.
It really is. And that's why I think people get so pissy about what comedians say, because it's uncomfortable to change gears sometimes, and then they're blaming it on the comedians who just said what you needed to hear. Ha!
Exactly.
Well, they need a lot more comedy and maybe a glass of wine. I don't know, but something.
A good book.
Take a chill pill or something.
Yeah. You know, if you go to a comedian show, that's what you signed up for.
Exactly.
Just saying. But Glenn, for you, a mentor, who would a mentor be for you?
A mentor?
For me?
Well, I mean, I would have had a different answer, but after today, Ilana and Lynn sound like both mentors I would like to learn from.
And
sure.
Lynn,
oh,
I teach you how to do dance skits, right? So, like, comedy dance, go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely have the body for dancing. I don't know if you remember that Chris Farley sketch when he did the Chippendales dancing, but it's not much too far off. Yeah.
See, that's cool. That's it.
That's it. That's so cool. She's just going to do it back to front.
I know. I love it. Well, thank you for joining us, you guys. Everyone, keep up with Glenn. Again, it is Glenn Rockowitz, and you can find him on Facebook. Just type in Glenn with two N's, Rockowitz. Good luck with that. And author page, and you'll find him. Type in Cotton Teeth. Go to Amazon. Find him there. Go get his memoirs. And Lynn Slaughter, go to lynnslaughter.com because she writes mystery and she may slaughter you.
And she kills people.
And it's Lynn with a L-Y-N-N. And then Ilana, go to etragirls.com, E-T-R-E, etragirls.com.
Yep.
And also go to Amazon for everybody here. And go to your local bookstores, just saying, independent bookstores.
Come on.
Got to do those too. Thank you for joining us. We're going to play a song from our friends, the Tall Men Group. And this is a song, Write a Freaking Book. And this is from their second album, Too Tall, by the Tall Men Group. And here it is. And then we've got another set of three authors joining us to do part two. So here it is.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
Baby, there's no doubt. If you try to hold them in, they just keep falling out. Your loquacious talent is hard to overlook. Why don't you stop that yapping at me and write a freaking book? Page after page, I know you could expound on all I'm doing wrong, but it wouldn't make a sound, and the fury would be silent where once these four walls shook. If you'd stop your yapping at me and write a freaking book, I'd take 100 years of solitude over all these grapes of wrath. Use a portrait of a lady until you cross my path. You need a heart of diamond to kill a mockingbird. And as I lay dying, I still hear every word. A river of syllables drips from your lips. Turn that water into wine. Hit the Times bestseller list. A Pulitzer Prize could stream from your babbling brook. If you'd stop that yapping at me and write a freaking book. Why don't you stop that yapping at me and write a freaking book?
Everyone, that was the Tall Men Group, and you can get their music on Amazon, all those great places, just like you can all the authors on our show today. This is our second part. Welcome to Big Blend Radio, if you're just tuning in. Nancy and Lisa, the crazy mother-daughter travel team and publishers of Big Blend Magazine. We've got three great authors joining us now, and for our second panel discussion, and we want to give a shout-out to Books Forward, because, again, like majority of the authors on our show, well, thank you, Books Forward, for being the ultimate hookup for authors, being awesome guests on your show. So I want to bring our first guest on. We've got Liz Keller Whitehurst, and you can go to her website, LizKellerWhitehurst.com. She is a podcast creator, which actually turned into a book, The Messenger. It's just called Messenger. She's a short story writer, novelist, English and writing educator. So I hope she never reads any of our magazines. She'll be emailing us. But welcome, Liz. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you all?
We're doing good. Where are you calling
from? Good. I just listened to your first show. It was awesome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Not the very first one, right? I hope. Not like from 15 years
ago.
Oh,
the
ago
one just before this.
Yeah, no, yeah, good. Good. I'm like,
so
if you
good.
Listened 15 years ago, you heard us with champagne going, yee-haw, welcome to Big Blend Radio. We did. We did way back when. They didn't have sound effects at that point when you did call-ins and podcasting. It was a little different. But welcome. Where are you calling from, though?
Thanks. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
That's oh, cool. Sweet. Sweet. This is awesome.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
So welcome to the show. I want to bring on
Thank you. Amy Daughters.
Amy is an award-winning author, freelance writer, and a researcher, and I think she knows a lot about sports. Her latest books, Dear Dana and You Can't Mess This Up. Yes, we can. I'm just telling you, Amy, we can. But you can go to her website, amydaughters.com. That's daughter as in your child. AmyDaughters.com. Welcome, Amy. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey,
cool.
It's good to have you here. I believe you're in Texas, the state that we're in right now.
Yes, I am outside of Houston in picturesque Tomball, Texas.
Oh. Well, we're like on the complete opposite side of the state from you today. We're in Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah, that's where my I went to the Texas Tech University, so I'm familiar with Loop 289 and all your environs up there in Lubbock.
That
so.
Is not our environment. We travel full time. We're just passing through, and all I know.
Oh, wow!
Is you guys do have a bunch of loopy road systems, not just here, but your entire state has loops. I mean, I don't
we
know
do.
About. You're loopy here.
Yeah, you have to do like a four-leaf clover to get off the freeway. Just keep.
Yeah. I think we're loopy in more ways than one. So we accept that.
Oh, well, no, but it's good to be back in Texas. You got sunshine. You know, it's a good place. We love being here. And I want to bring our next guest on, Lori R. Snyder. She is the author of The Circus at the End of the Sea. She is a writer, educator, and creator of this new movement. Well, it's a movement, the Writer's Happiness Movement. Very cool. And you can go to writershappiness.com and also Lori, L-O-R-I, Lori R. Snyder, author.com. So welcome, Lori. How are you?
Hi, it's great to be here. I'm really happy to be with all of you today is how I am.
You
cool.
too. Welcome. And where are you?
Well, I live in Los Angeles, but I'm actually in the middle of a long road trip up to the top of California to visit my mom. So I'm currently in a hotel room in Livermore, California, which
Ooh,
is kind of
oh,
in the middle
country.
Of the state.
Well,
oh,
wine
there.
Country. Awesome. We just drove through that. Like, yeah, mm. we've been, yeah, we crossed paths, but not at the same time.
Yeah. Darn it.
But very nice. Very nice part of the country. So, yeah, wonderful to have all three of you here because I think we're going to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of writing. You know, it's very interesting. I want to go to you, Liz. Tell us about Messenger. Just give us a synopsis of the story because, like, which came first, the podcast or the book?
Chicken or the egg.
Mm-hmm. I know. We can cook breakfast right now or dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. The story came first. The
mm-hmm.
story of Messenger came first. And Messenger is about a mysterious woman in New York City who's going around the city giving life-changing messages to seemingly random people. And Alana, who is a young journalist, trying to make her big break, and she finds out about this and wants to tell Messenger's story. And as the story unfolds and the trajectory of the story plummets forward, we realize that things are not as they have seemed, both for Alana and Messenger. So that's the gist of it. And I had written the book, and it was ready to go in 2019. And my agent had shopped it, and we gotten some nice reads. But no, this was my debut novel, though not my first novel, as I'm sure is true of all the rest of our panelists. Anyway, nothing was happening, and then COVID struck.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
for an unknown writer with no established audience, I knew my chances were not so good as to, getting my big book deal as I had always envisioned it. So I woke up the morning before my birthday in April of 2020 and said, this story has got to get out because I really feel like it has things to offer that were very timely. And I kept thinking, it's about this, it's about that. But it can help with, I felt like it's time had come and I had to get it out. And so what I ended up doing, to make a long story short, is enlisting the help and collaboration of local creatives who had time on their hands because of COVID. And we made this podcast, a serial podcast. First launched in July of 2020, and an episode would come out each week, the 16 episodes. So it's Messenger, a novel, in 16 episodes. You can still listen to it wherever you listen.
Yeah, it's right on your website, LizKellerWhiteHearth.com.
And it's on my website, or you listen wherever you like to listen. It was free. It was an offering. So there you go. And the end of the story was I was able – I think because of that and the audience that developed around it, to get a book deal. And
see,
so Messenger, the print book came out in October of 2021.
See, I love that you turned something around because you know, when you have these situations, you go, okay, that's it, we're done. During COVID, we watched people like basically close up shop, and I'm like, everybody still has a story to tell, and we went daily with our radio show, now we're actively daily, and, you know, it's you cannot take a negative, you got to turn it into a positive, but I want to go to Amy Daughters. Amy, with you, didn't you have a whole thing about messaging, too, and writing messages?
Yeah. My story, the Dear Dana, is my book that just came out in May, just a couple of weeks ago, and it's a story.
Congratulations!
Thank you. It's a story that just happened to me. I reconnected on Facebook with an old friend from a summer camp. I found out her son had cancer, was at St. Jude in Memphis, and so he was likely fighting for his life. And I'm a writer, so I thought, oh, I just got inspired. Suddenly, I'll write them letters. So I began to write them letters. Her son sadly passed away at 15, and I didn't know what else to do, so I was like, well, I guess I'll just keep writing the letters. So I continued to write her. 4 or 5 months later, she started to write me back, and we had this profound relationship with someone who I, you know, didn't really know anything about, just had distant memories of. For 2 years, we communicated just through the mail, and it became like just an experience where non-instantaneous communication works. You know, our thoughts would pass in the mail, so there was no expectations. It was very freeing, and I was about 6 months into our pen palling, and I sat back and I said, you know, if this is so life-changing, what happens if I write all the Facebook people a letter? So I don't think I really ever thought I was going to pull it off, but I wrote 580 handwritten letters and developed these amazing relationships, and there was, I mean, it was funny, it was poignant, it was sad, it was profound, it was life-changing, and so the book Dear Dana takes those two narratives and weaves them together and just basically chronicles this story that just absolutely blew my life up and my heart up more than anything else.
Wow. See, this just shows the power of the pen and the power of words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the words are connectivity, and sometimes, you know, when someone's sick or, you know, you can't talk to them face-to-face or be there, you know, a written note, they can look back on when they're feeling better. You know, it's words last when they're written down, you know.
Right.
They
and,
really do.
And people were so, I was so surprised because people were so impacted. Like I told everybody in each letter, I'm writing everyone a letter. And they were like, oh my God, I got picked. Even though I was very clear, but it's just the deliberate act, especially, and I'm not saying social media, I think it's good and bad, but when you deliberately sit down and write somebody handwritten, then you have to get an envelope, and you have to find a stamp and an address, and you have to drive it across town and put it in an envelope, people feel in a mailbox because you're treating them individually. And I had no idea at all the impact that would have on people. We've just done a bunch of, you know, a few book signings, and people come to the book signings with the letter from 4 years ago because they want me to see it. So,
see, I think that's a big deal. And Nancy, you talk about that with Facebook and social media. She's always like, you know, it's a good connector, but we need to do better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is important what you've done, and it's a book, so it really will keep transcending. I want to go to Lori R. Snyder. Lori, you know, you're the author of The Circus at the End of the Sea. And I love the title, and I love the art, and I haven't read it, but I want to, because it's just something very magical about what you're doing with this book. It just feels magical. It feels like you could be at the end of the pier, jump off, and something magical will happen instead of the negative. That's just my immediate thing about it, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but that's just how it felt. Like everything seems magical with what you're doing.
I love that, because that's a big theme in my life, and Circus at the End of the Sea is about the magic that's all around us, and it's my love letter to Venice, California, which is one of the great, great loves of my life.
Oh, we love Venice Beach. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yes. Excellent. So I've most of my adult life when I've been in LA. Yes, exactly. The drum circle is in the book, and it is a magical drum circle. So just so you know, if you have been to Venice, you will recognize a lot of what's in the book, because to me, Venice is like stepping out into the most magical parade. And like when I would, you know, when I put on my skates and I go out to the bike path, I would always say, okay, I'm going out to the parade. See you later.
And the umbrella lady. To me, don't forget the umbrella lady.
Yes.
Did you see the umbrella lady?
I don't know if she's even alive anymore.
You mean the one who skates with the umbrella?
No, she used to sit there with there was drums, and then. Oh, I have photos of her. She was.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
maybe
this was
long ago.
No, like on the side. And then there's, okay. But anyway, it was like years ago. We haven't been there for a while. So anyway, sorry.
I've lived there a long time, so I'm sure I have. Yes. I love that. It's my place too. It's like, it's that place where you feel like you can step outside of mainstream culture and you can land in this magical circus. And so The Circus at the End of the Sea is in fact about a really lonely girl who doesn't know where she belongs and has never met her parents and has seen magic her whole life. And she's being moved from one group home to another one that's in Venice. And the bus mysteriously breaks down right by Windward Circle, which is what's shown on the cover of the book. It's this iconic circle in Venice where it has some of the architecture from the original building of Venice of America back in the early 1900s. And she gets off the bus and this magical fog comes in. And when the fog recedes, the bus driver has no record of her anymore on his list. And she's basically free. And of course, this could be scary, but she is thrilled. All she's ever wanted to do is follow the magic. And she's been told, no, it doesn't exist over and over. And now she has this opportunity. So she follows after the magic that she sees, and she ends up finding this magical street circus that is Venice. And it's what it is incorporated all of the actual very bizarre things that are in Venice already are in it, and with a little bit of a magical twist. And honestly, they didn't need much of a twist because they're already pretty wild. So it's her adventure to figure out how she and the circus are connected and what she has to do to save it. And it's really a story about coming home to yourself. It's a story about how we see the magic around us. It's a story about found family. And it's the story in recognizing that life isn't about this artificial sort of duality, good, bad, that we put on things, but it's the totality of everything and the wholeness of everything. And only when we recognize that wholeness can we step into our actual future.
Wow, I love this. Okay. You three ladies, see, it's so weird how things happen on these shows where people just are on the channel together and the right people. It just happens. And the three of you are connected by positivity. Truly, I think this is the positive power of, you know, your messaging and what you do as writers. And I think that's a really good thing that we do need in our country and our world right now. And I mean our world for sure. And so the written word can be, you know, translated into different cultures and different languages. So it can transcend. So for you, Lori, do you see that book as something that can transcend just through what youth are going through in general, but in youth around the world, because they're fighting all kinds of things, you know, just in general.
Yeah.
I hate to generalize like, hey, sorry, I have to leave my home country right now because, you know, we're blowing up or, you know, climate change or whatever, but it could help them have some hope that, you know, that deep seed that they have that they could still do things, you know, and make them move forward.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so. I hope so. I feel like, you know, part of what my book is about and part of what I think is really helpful to for all of us, not just youth, is this idea of widening our family, what our definition of family is. And if we have to, if our family isn't what we hope it was, or even if it is, that we can make this bigger to include all of us. And that means going forward, we work as a whole, we work as a unit. And that's a theme that goes very much through the book too, this idea of change and allowing ourselves to become who we want to become with the people around us. And I feel as though, you know, I don't think this is a very easy time to be young. I mean, in some ways, it's never easy to be young, but I think this is a challenging time. And I think as adults, we tend to put a lot of responsibility on our kids. Oh, you're all going to save us. This generation is going to save us. And I feel like the reminder of the magic that there is and all this beauty in the world and how much hope there is and how many people are doing amazing things is a really important reminder for all of us, for kids and adults alike.
Well, look at Amy. Look, Amy, what you did is this little magic that went out there. And Liz, what you did too, putting out the podcast is something positive when people are like, holy hell, what's happening to our world? We're all going to die from this crazy virus, you know, and people did die.
Mm.
But you're putting out something positive. I mean, that's what I said about all three of you. There is that. And I think there's something powerful about words and doing it right. So I want to go to each of you about the responsibility of what you do put out there. It's hard enough to write, but then thinking about how is that message going to hit? So Liz, for you, with Messenger, you have the story, and then now I'm going to put it out there as a podcast, and here comes the novel, but that story is out there, and you knew you needed to do it. But did you feel like responsibility when you did that, that it would be accepted the right way?
Well, you never know that, and that's the high wire act.
Yeah.
The way I look at it is that I did feel that this was a given, this message was given, the whole book is a message, and that it came through me, and then it was my responsibility to serve it as best I could. And then you let go because it's out of your hands. Once even one person reads a book, the book has ever changed because it's their book now. So I really had that sense, especially with this book. But I did have aims and hopes for it. I love this quote that kind of ties in with what we've been talking about by Jane Hirschfield. Hope is the hardest love we carry. And I think that has certainly been true the last 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we must carry it. It's just as Lori is saying, and just as Amy demonstrated, and being a messenger for others by, you know, sending all those messages out to people that really had a profound effect. We're all in this together, and it's what we put out there is what's going to decide the end of the story.
Do you feel, I don't mean to be woo-woo, but I'm going to be woo-woo.
Uh-oh.
Because no, I'm
oh,
going
go
off of
it.
All the author interviews we've done over the years. I mean, yeah. Thousands of them. And, you know, I said this in the segment before, that some authors have their characters like, say, no, you're doing this wrong. This is my story here. You need to write this. And so it's almost like they're channeling someone. And it just seems kind of with all three of you that there's this other like, hello, this needs to happen. And did you feel that, Lori? Like there was like a not, I'm not getting woo-woo, but I am. I can't help it. You know, like you need to put this out there. You need to be the messenger.
Well, first of all, I'm a longtime yoga teacher, and I used to own a yoga studio, so I'm all about the woo-woo, so you can bring that on with me.
Let's
go
you
woo-woo.
You need to teach me how to bend better so that when I'm out on the ocean trying to surf, my butt doesn't go in the air the way it does, like I just said on the earlier segment. So I need to come see you.
Lots of upward dog poses. There you go. That'll
do
it for you.
Yeah.
true. So So it's interesting because with the book, I write a really backwards way, and from what I understand other people write. I don't feel like I have a character who comes to talk to me and takes over the story, but I do kind of what you were saying. I do start from a theme, which is a very backward way to write a novel. And so I did have this theme of, I'm like, I want to write a love letter to Venice and to magic and to delight. And I thought to myself when I was writing this book that I'm not going to write anything that doesn't delight me. Like if a sentence doesn't delight me, I'm taking it out. And that was really my gauge for the book. And there's a lot of my philosophy on life woven through the book because we all do that, right? I mean, there's no way to write a book and not do that. But mine was fairly deliberate. And I think I do tend to think really carefully about every word I write. I think really carefully about every word I say when I teach yoga because I want to make sure I'm telling the truth to the best of my ability. So it didn't feel like there was a specific message I wanted to get across, but as the story took shape, the message the story was going to hold became really clear, and I did work very hard to make it as truthful to what I meant to say as possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so does that mean that you do backward dog? Like if you're going backward?
Yes, I love downward it. I totally dog. Do backward dog.
Okay, I do downward dog. It's the closest I get to push-ups, and I did all these push-up exercises, but yeah.
The pets that we pet sit as we travel the country, and I have to say cats do downward dog the best.
They do.
They do it beautifully.
They really do.
They do beautifully.
They're the best yogas. Like, I mean, the yogis, they are like, hello, if we can do that and stretch out. But there is something about that touches into writing because it's like, here's, you know, when you've got this idea brewing, you're like, I want to, like, I know, like, I have, this is the story I'm going to write in this next magazine. I've got it. And it's like this bubble, like, and then it's like, how do you get it out? Well, you watch a cat, and they're just like, dude, just massage it out, just stretch it, and things will roll. Like, you know, you're getting too uptight about this. You're getting overly excited. You got to chill. So it is interesting about how every writer approaches this. Amy, for you, how is it? I mean, that's crazy how that all happened, but it is almost like you're like, you will do this now. You're like, move on with it. But this was your second book, right, Dear Dana?
Right, and it was, like, what Liz said was kind of what I felt like. Like, this, I was the protector of this message. I was the protector of the story, and it was my job to go out and tell it. What I was real careful about is in writing 600 people with different beliefs and different political views that I had. What I realized in reaching out to each of those people, you know, and nothing more really than goodwill and them replying to me, I became to realize that all that stuff starts to fade away, which is such a powerful message right now. All those differences and the divisiveness starts to fade away when we approach each other individually, you know, and so really what I wanted the book to do was not to be a reflection of my values, but to welcome everyone, all 600 people I wrote to, and then the readers beyond that. And I think that the thing I wanted people to, and it really wasn't intentional because I didn't do the project intentionally to write a book. I didn't write the letters to send a message or to do anything. But what I found out that is that really this hope we're so desperate for, and this is what I want people to get out of my book, is that what the hope we're so desperate for is in our connections. It's right next to us. It's across town, the other end of a screen. Because when we reach out to each other, that's where we find that hope, you know, and our differences melt away. So that's really the message I came up with. But it was really very non-intentionally on my part.
I think it's really cool what you've done because, like Nancy says, there's just so much. I'm having to stop the way I say that. Language, please come, because Facebook gets mean and YouTube and people. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nancy's having to kick people off of our YouTubes on things, you know, all the time because people can hide. They take their anger out in weird ways and can hide on the internet and do it, and it's bizarre. It's just bizarre. And at the same time, we're all different opinions and politically and all that stuff. But we should get together. And it is about watching how we say things and write things. And I think, again, when it's written in ink, whether you're reading it on a screen or on a Kindle or, whatever, or written words or a letter, when something is typed, written, there's something just that it's there. That was meant to be there. So I hope none of you get any of my text messages because they're full of typos. But right, the meaning is there. And I think that's the importance of the written word with what you do as writers. And Liz, for you, going to, you know, the messenger, or messenger, I shouldn't say the messenger, but messenger, that is something that is important too, right, is how that gets on. Is, and you did it audio, right, so that's an important part too. And writing a book is getting the messages out. That's positivity. When people needed it, you had to do different versions, but you still wrote the stories. Even if it's a podcast, you still put it down in paper.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that experience of hearing the book read, but I had a very, very talented vocal actor named Rachel Pater, who is also a dear friend. And again, like I was saying earlier, how the book has a life of its own. It took on a different, it was a different dimension having it be an audiobook at first. Because listening to something, and of course, Rachel is interpreting it, you know, the way she's read it. And I mean, we would talk about certain characters and certain things, but in the end, She's reading it. She's acting it. So it's a different book. And so it, this was a very interesting creative experience. And I think it's different. Some people like the podcast. It's interesting. Some people love the podcast, but then some of the podcast listeners said, I really like books, you know, on paper, you know, or the written, like you were saying earlier, talking about seeing the written word is what I love. And then some people like both and have enjoyed both. So it's you know, if whatever anyone loves, go for it. Do it your way.
You know, if you pick up a book and read it from your point of view, your personality, and so it becomes your book. Now, when somebody's reading it to you, that complicates it a little bit in that now you have two viewpoints, because the voice inflection of the person reading is what they feel.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I like it because now you have a different opinion. Now, some people don't like different opinions, you know, so that could be something, I'd rather just read it myself. You know, other people like, I'd rather hear it. You know, some people want to watch it on screen. Some want to hear it. Some want to read it themselves. Some will do all three.
Most people I know are listening to books now. Audio books are like king, you know. And I think it's just that we're in that zone of being busy, doing things, and multitasking. And if you're driving, you want to read, you can't, you know, you want to listen, you know.
Right, of course.
And you have a captive audience there. Tell me about it. I mean, I drive for a living. I'm a truck driver. No, I'm not a truck driver. I feel like I am. You know, as we travel the country nonstop, that's how I feel, you know. It's, you know, when you hear anybody tell a story, whether it be talk radio or somebody doing a play on air, you're like, I'm in. I want to listen to the story because it keeps you engaged and you're into it, and you do fall into the character voices, and it's about getting the right voice
it's
and the
cool.
right person to do it where it is not as, Nancy's right. You will get, you know, you could read something and have a different voice than who you have, but for the author, it's how you, you know, who you pick that goes as close to how you wrote it. Yeah.
That's
but
right.
I think it's amazing in what the written and you know, verbal word too. But I want to
go into a little bit about the writing part of things. You know, Lori, it's very interesting what you're doing with this writer's happiness movement, because I'm going to say that the music and the writing, the arts industry as a whole, is having a huge problem. I mean, musicians, if you think you can make money on Spotify, no, go to Bandcamp. But put your music out there for you know, good measure of getting, you know, known and things like that. But it's just not that easy, yet at the same time we have self-publishing. We do have all these tools, but it's a crazy world. So tell us a little bit about writers' happiness movement, because a lot of writers I know, they're like, writing the book is blood, sweat, and tears, and then I have to market it, and that's like a whole other set of blood, sweat, and tears I don't need to do.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about what you're doing with that.
So I probably should start by saying, well, the idea behind the writer's happiness movement is that I wanted to live in a world where kindness and the arts and magic. Yeah, I do live in that world already, to be totally honest. but I wanted people who were doing these wonderful things and creating art of any kind. I want that to matter in the way that. And when I say matter, we love it now, but we don't really reward it. We don't reward it financially mm-hmm. for most people. We expect right. it to be squeezed in between other things, and we don't take anyone seriously who's making art until they're famous and have a lot of money. And so it's really challenging to create art for most people, because where do you find the time? You have a day job, you have a family, you have responsibilities, you have everything else going on. What do you give up in order to write or create your art? And I also really wanted to build something that would offer an alternative way for people to come together and have community. I mean, it's really fascinating. I feel like, you know, Liz and Amy, I love so much what both of you are writing about, because it's this sense of meaningful community. Like, how do we connect mm-hmm. meaningfully with each other?
Yeah.
And
yeah. Right.
And so the writer's happiness movement is I'm still working on putting it into words, as you can tell, as I like sort of stumble over this, even though it's been around for 2 years now, because I don't offer business feedback. I don't offer craft classes. What I do is offer what I call free happiness tools for writers. And that includes free online retreats that are a mix of writing time and community and yoga and meditation for writers that I lead. I offer a weekly live online yoga for writers that's free. I offer writing salons where we get together online and we have conversations on a certain topic that relates to writing. I do have right now what I call micro grants, which are little $25 cash awards that go to a writer that somebody has nominated. So people can go to writershappiness.com. You can nominate a writer you know. The requirements are that that person is a writer of any kind. They don't have to be published. They don't have to write anything in particular. And the other requirement is that you think they're amazing, and you write a little explanation of why you think they're amazing. And the whole idea is just to cheer a writer on. It's $25 cash. It comes in this beautiful art card that my dear friend Lisa Acapinti designed for me. It comes with the little note that your friend wrote about you if you're one of the recipients. And it's just like, here, we see you, and what you're doing matters. And this whole thing is supported by what I think of as like this alternative economic system, which is, anybody who can and wants to become a patron of Writers' Happiness Movement can support it at $5 a month. And that money goes not just to the technology that I need to have to make this all happen, but it goes to these micro grants. And as the patronage grows, the idea is that I'll be able to do bigger things like larger grants. But even bigger than that, I want to build residencies that writers can go work at for a month, all expenses paid, including expenses that they will of lost wages during that time, so they don't lose money by taking time off to go write. I want to build retirement homes for writers. Like, these are the big vision going forward. And what I want from this is to create space where creativity can happen that is accessible to anybody who wants it, and not just I have money and time to go to a conference, which is where a lot of connections get made. So that's the idea behind it, is that we all come together, and these are all things that, it's all various aspects. I've had a lot of careers, and these are all various aspects of my life. Like, these are things I can do if the funding is there. And so as people join in at $5 a month or give a one-time donation, my idea is $5 a month is hopefully small enough that anyone who wants to help build this kind of a world and wants to support this vision can do it, but not so big that it's overwhelming. But, I mean, can you imagine? Like, my goal is to have 100,000 writers supporting it at $5 a month. What I can build for writers is spectacular. I could build these retirement homes. I could build residencies. We could all support each other in having space to write.
I just, my mind immediately goes to not exactly a sitcom, but pretty close to a TV series where you have a lot of retired writers who are now really getting to write full time because they're retired,
right?
All in the same place.
Uh-oh.
And then, no, come on, because they go to, you know, they have meals together and they have sherry time or whatever, wine time. And then the fun begins where they start criticizing each other's works or throwing ideas out there. That would be a great TV
But this is really something that has happened historically. If you go back in time, you know, writers and artists and musicians
mm-hmm.
came together in places and
mm-hmm.
Had residencies. You know, Natchitoches, Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
there was the Melrose Plantation. And writers gathered there, artists, and they would stay there for 6 months or so. And the rich people of the plantation would host them. You know,
mm-hmm.
kind of
mm-hmm.
going back in old history, that the arts were, you were part of like the palace, and people revered your art, and you were kind of like part of this, not the staff. I don't want to say that, but
no,
you were supported
the
because the arts were way up there as important parts of life. Somewhere, it just kind of, you know, you either make a ton of money or you're screwed. It's one or the other,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you have to have a second or third job to do what you want. Musicians are facing the same thing. It's a very important thing because you could be a really good writer. And at the same time, how do you survive doing that and have the time to craft it? If you're working 9 to 5 and then you still need to write, you, like you said, what are you sacrificing? And
mm-hmm.
are you doing your best? Or maybe you are. Who knows? You know, everybody's different in regards to that, because it could be that in working under pressure, you put out your best work. Everyone is different. But I think you're onto something where people do need, and I don't even know if nonprofit is the way to go anymore. Honestly, we've looked into things like that just in what we do, and we work with a gazillion nonprofits. It's a very interesting thing because at the end of the day, people do need to pay for the arts. You can't just be a musician giving free music just for notoriety, an author doing a reading for free for nothing. You know what I mean? It's not just that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something has to be given back by the public for what they're receiving. And I think so that's something I want to go to you, Amy. You're a freelance writer too, and that world changed a whole bunch over the years, didn't it?
Oh, it did. I mean, now everything, I mean, getting in a print magazine or a newspaper is almost impossible unless you are a celebrity or have a
mm-hmm.
voice that it's almost like getting a book deal. You
mm-hmm.
you have to have some
yeah.
kind of name and a following automatically, which I think Liz mentioned at the beginning. You have to have some kind of automatic financial, you know, promise to get a big deal or to get a spot in a magazine. So in one way, the online world has opened it up for a bunch of people, but it's also minimized the amount of money you can make doing it. So
that's a good point.
It's a different thing. I mean, even us as publishers, we're independent, and it's a whole other world out there now, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's totally different.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to you, Liz, because you also teach not just writing, but, you know, English. I mean, where are we on people learning? I mean, everything's hashtags now. What do you think about the world of writing right now in the English language? How do you feel?
Well, I actually, my last teaching gig was as a co-teacher in our city jail. So that was a little different experience.
Cool.
But I loved it.
Yeah.
And I just think, my husband was talking about this at dinner tonight, everybody really wants to write a book, or mm-hmm. you know, there's writing, or there's messages, meaning that people are dying to get out of themselves and share it
mm-hmm.
in some way. And
yeah.
so, you know, I think as in everything, we're in lots of times of changes in every field and every aspect of life. It's challenging, but I think some really exciting things are going to come out. And I must say, you know, our students at the jail were just like my same students at Virginia Commonwealth
mm-hmm.
University and University of Richmond. Once we got in the class, they got the pencils in the hand, because they don't have computers, but pencils and paper,
mm-hmm.
and we give them a prompt. It comes out. Their message comes out, and they're excited to share it.
Mm,
so
that's
I think
beautiful.
It's a human, it's just a human impulse. I mean, it was the first to go back as far as any sense of civilization,
mm-hmm.
you know, around the fire telling stories.
Well, and I think mm-hmm. when people end up in jail or prison, something really went wrong somewhere in their upbringing.
Trauma.
They've been traumatized in some way. I'm not sure if I believe in that you're just born evil. I don't see that.
Everyone, I mean, just being in jail is traumatizing, believe me.
I'm sure.
Just going into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was interesting because this is the first time I had taught in this population.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Many, many, many of them wanted to write about their trauma.
Okay.
But many of them wanted to go back to their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And they would write about their grandmother's kitchen and the food she would cook,
mm-hmm.
you know, for them on a Sunday. Or they'd write about a trip to the beach with their dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would go to a happy memory or a biting
mm-hmm.
image. So it's very interesting.
It's going to what the positive, you know, because the negatives are the negatives. And there's the stability. You know, if you have a dinner on a Sunday at your grandma's house,
mm-hmm.
that's a stability. That is a sense of love and a consistency. That's probably mm-hmm. what they... you know, long and miss. And, you know, I think there's something about memoir writing, you know, people writing memoirs and
yeah.
having some reality there along with the magic there, Lori. We can have memoirs and magic together for sure, you know. But I want to go to each of you. One tip you would give to someone right now, starting, we're talking about the money aspect, the you know, hey, we're doing things a little bit different, like what Amy's doing. And Liz, I mean, everybody's doing something different here. So someone wants to write a book and, you know, you think, God, this is a huge process. Like, oh, my God, but I want to do it. And maybe they're halfway through. Who knows? It's just they want to write. So let's start with you, Lori. One quick tip for someone getting started.
My quick tip is don't give up. Even if you have to put it aside for a little while, don't give up. Come back to it because you can make it through. Even if you're writing 10 minutes a day, don't give up.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Mm.
For you, Amy, what tip would you be giving? Do it through Facebook. No, kidding.
Now, I would say that you know, the best day of writing a book, in my opinion, is not the day that somebody buys the book deal or the day it gets published. It's the day you write the last word. So don't get caught up in what's going to happen next. Get caught up in just doing it your way. There's no rules to writing a book. Do it your way. Be confident. You're a writer the day you sit down with the computer or the paper or whatever your process is. You're a writer. Validate yourself. And then count the greatest day as the day you write the last sentence.
Mm.
Ooh, I like that.
Okay.
What about you, Liz? What is your tip?
Well, the first thing I would say is sign up for the Writer's Happiness Project because you need a community. And that's what I'm going to do the minute we say goodnight, ladies.
so exciting cool. about hearing about that. But the other thing I would say is, and this might sound crazy, let go of your dreams. That was a mistake I made as a writer. I had in my mind the path that my career would take. I would do this, 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 and this, just like the famous writers I loved and read about and read their letters and their memoirs. That held me back from thinking outside of the box and finding a way, even if I got a no.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you have to let go of the way you think it's going to play out, or it should play out, or you've always been told it would, or you've always dreamed it would for you, and find a way to get your story out there. And then who knows what might happen. That's certainly what happened to me. I wish I'd done that a lot earlier
in my life and career. Sound like a Virgo, like me. Like, I had to learn to get over it. Like, just, this is your thing, and get over it if it is not the way you, you know.
No, but in people's defense, the times move a lot faster than they used to.
Yeah, you know, like what
we were brought up believing has changed so much, but it hasn't, it changes quicker every day.
And so
we're having to keep up. In fact, and so I sometimes get scared of losing history because we're moving so fast that where is history now, you know?
In the written word. In the arts. History is stored in the arts because the arts always tell the truth of what's going on. Even if it's fiction, it's telling you what happened in the time that that book was written.
We're moving so fast, and I don't know what our hurry is. I don't know where we think we're going. But
to space.
We're working so fast that everything is supposed to be instant, and then you get really upset when it isn't because you've been taught it's supposed to be now. And so you think about when you're talking about writing, which takes thought and emotion and empathy and all sorts of looking at things from different perspectives. How can you do that instantly? Come on.
Right. That's why Amy wrote letters. See?
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. See? Going back to that. So, ladies, we've got to get going. So,
okay.
Last question, each of you. All right, because we're going to have a dinner party before you go. So one person coming to the dinner table, all right, and no, we're not cooking dinner, but we're ordering catering, and whoever is coming to the table can order whatever they want. Nancy and I will serve it, and, you know, we'll play wine steward. Okay.
Cool.
So one person that you want to sit, all three of you are going to be at the same dinner table, and you're going to invite one person. Yeah, everybody's at the party, right?
Okay.
And,
okay.
You get to each invite one person, and so we want to know who it is so that it's someone you can learn from, be inspired from, or just laugh with, whoever it is, alive or passed on. So let's start with you, Liz. Who are you bringing on, well, not on, but inviting to the dinner table?
Well, I always want to meet and break bread with the author of the book I'm currently reading, if I'm loving it. And so I am currently reading To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara, and I would love to have dinner with her. She has created a huge book, a huge world. The first section is set in the late 1800s. The second section, the late 1900s. And the third, the late 50 years from now.
Wow.
And she has created a whole new world. The United States is very, very different. It's an alternate reality, but just a fascinating one. And she it's perfect. She did it. And I think that I just admire her writing so much. So
yeah,
I would love to meet her.
That's taking a leap. That's taking a leap.
Oh, gosh.
And who doesn't want an alternate reality for a little bit? I mean, right now, I think we could all use it. You know, so that's what books are, right? You could travel the world in a book and beyond, right?
Oh, sure.
Exactly. And I have been in her world, and I just I would love to meet her and talk about
that
it.
That means you've been on a different planet. We want to know more.
For real, for real.
What planet are we having this dinner party on? Would it be Mars? Or I don't want to say Uranus for a dinner party. But anyway.
Lisa.
Sorry. This came out. Oopsie. But anyway, Amy.
It's
not
going to
get
planet.
Better. Nothing gets better out of my mouth. But Amy, yeah. You, who's coming to the dinner table? And we'll have it on planet Earth in America, okay?
Yeah, I'm not mature enough for your planetary reference, but I appreciate it very much. So, first of all, I just want to say that sitting down with dinner with the two of you and then with Liz and Lori would be a great honor, just like it is to be. I'm kind of blown away by this whole thing. I didn't know what to expect. I just want to say it would be an honor to sit down and have dinner with you ladies. I've learned a lot just in this 45 minutes.
Thank you, Amy.
So I agree with what you said, that we're all positive. I feel really inspired by the group. But I would bring Eleanor Roosevelt because
ooh,
I think at the time that she, you know, did her thing, I mean, she basically just carved out her own way in a world that was much more in a box even than we are now. And I would love to sit down and tell these stories to her and get her take on them and then just hear her wisdom and inspiration and even tell her what's going on in our world right now and have her give her thoughts about that. So
we'll have to do some really strong tea for her, you know.
me and her were going to order the chicken wings. That's what we were going to get, but, you know.
Yeah, heck yeah. So. But, I mean, she's all about, like, being strong as a tea bag. You know, like, you've got to be strong
she's
as
cool.
women.
She was cool.
She was so vocal and with her
she's
husband.
She's so
cool. You know, I got sucked in. I think I watched her PBS special like twice and got sucked in so much because she really, I think, was one of those early feminists, really, who stood up for everything, not just women, but like the freedom of expression and all of it.
She didn't do the female flirty kind of
look at my body
thing.
No, be who you.
She went on values and intellect.
She rolls her eyes like you do, Nancy. Nancy rolls her eyes all the time. We do all these Zoom interviews and I have to look at Nancy like, don't roll your eyes. Don't. You know,
she was herself 100% and then she was for everybody. She wasn't just for one group. She was for everybody.
Everybody.
And she was for what was right, regardless of politics or religion. That's what she was for. And I just
individuality,
one example.
Freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom of expression. We could use her right now. That's
a good
person. So, Lori,
totally
who's coming to the dinner table for you? This is a good party.
I was going to say this is already the best party ever, but I'd have to bring Lin-Manuel Miranda because I just adore him.
Oh yeah,
that'd
be great.
And cool. I do also have to say that if Eleanor Roosevelt's going to be in there, I have to sneak in my mom because my mom would love to meet her. So I'm glad to too.
That's the best.
But alternate reality. We have in-your-face reality with Eleanor, and then we've got Lin Miranda who's going to go, like, come on, let's turn your books into a play and let's have some music. So I say this is the perfect party ever. I love it. Thank you, ladies, for joining us on the show today. Okay, so Liz Keller Whitehurst, you go LizKellerWhitehurst.com, and you'll find her there. And watch out for her. Well, it's out. Go get messages. Her podcast is right there on the homepage, and you can go get her book right there. And I love on her website that you can buy her book from independent bookstores.
I love that.
Kudos, Liz, for that. That is awesome.
Thank you. And thank you so much for tonight. What a blast. Thank you
so
much.
It's been awesome.
Glad you enjoyed it.
AmyDaughters.com, go get Dear Dana and also her other book, You Cannot Mess This Up. Nancy and I are here to say, yes, we can.
So can I.
I have that feeling. It's been really fun getting to know you. Thank you for joining us. It's been pleasure. It's really been a pleasure. And Amy, what you did writing to people on Facebook, your friends.
That's awesome.
I know Nancy's just, you know, doing like a cartwheel dance, even though she doesn't want to do one for you because she just gets annoyed with half of the crud on Facebook and
so
the lack
stupid.
Of... true connectivity. So I think mm-hmm. that is awesome. And Lori, everybody go to writershappiness.com and also get more of her magic at LoriRSnyderAuthor.com. Thank you all for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Again, Lori's book is The Circus at the End of the Sea. Thank you for joining us, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you, Books Forward. Go to BooksForward.com and keep up with us at BigBlendRadio.com. Thanks, everyone.